Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you through their stories, life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Hi, I'm Rob Greaves, and it's a pleasure to host part two of a four-part program featuring the life and times of Mike Rudd. Born in New Zealand in 1945, we learned in part one that Mike cut his teeth singing as a boy chorister in his school choir, but the lure of the rock pop scene that was blasting out of the USA and UK was too strong to ignore, and he formed his own group in New Zealand, which gained a comfortable residency. Yet comfort really wasn't in the young Rudd's musical lexicon, and using an inheritance, he flew his whole band to Melbourne in 1966 to find fame and gain a better set of musical skills. This week we learn how he connected with Ross Wilson and took up playing bass with the Party Machine. But fate saw the demise of that group when Wilson headed for the UK, so Mike was forced to form his own group. And we learn how he connected with Bill Putt, who would become his closest friend and his music compatriot over many bands and many decades. We learn how Spectrum came into being and how the universally known and loved I'll Be Gone track set him and Spectrum up for a long career. We also learn how the changing nature of the music scene in the 1970s forced Mike to form the spin-off Mertzips. The stories come thick and fast, and a lot of the gaps which are part of the history of Mike begin to get filled. We pick up with Mike talking about his role as the bass player in Party Machine.
Playing bass, I was a particular kind of bass player. I started off with a six-string guitar because I'd been so used to playing guitar. And my approach was probably different from any other bass player on the planet. I don't know. When I listen back to the band, I think that my bass contribution was as much different as the band was, that we were all sort of learning our craft together.
Mentioned that Party Machine folding, and I don't know whether you did use or were intimating forced you or encouraged you into your own band. Yes. Had you thought about doing that before Party Machine folded, or was that the trigger?
I rarely think ahead. I just go with the flow. Happens. So I was kind of shocked when Ross said I'm going over to London, and it kind of left me in the position to go, well, I better form my own band then, I suppose. Mm. I better write a song or two. And just strangely enough, almost the first people that came through the door were what the band turned out to be. So
was that by deliberate design or accident that those people came together? Did you actually advertise or put the word out, or did it just...
No, I didn't advertise, but I had seen Mark Kennedy playing with a band, with Bill Putt actually playing guitar, and I thought, wow, this guy is a fantastic player. If I can get in touch with him, I'd love to have him as a drummer. And he and Bill turned up together. Oh, okay. So I was still playing bass at that stage, and after a few rehearsals, I decided, oh, no, this is probably better if I actually play guitar. Because I'm writing the song, so we swapped.
Mm. A most fortuitous situation then that Bill came along with Mark at that stage, and I'd certainly like to talk to you about Bill a little bit later, given that the sixth anniversary of his passing comes up probably about the time this goes to air.
Okay.
But he turned up as a guitarist then, or as a bass player?
As a guitarist. Yeah.
So did you encourage him to play bass? How did that happen?
Oh, I... more or less, as I said, it was at that stage we were rehearsing with a Hammond player who conveniently lived just behind where I lived. He was from West Australia, David Skews, and he had that sort of whole Hammond rig, and it sounded fantastic. I just loved the sound of a Hammond, and I'd formulated this idea that that's what the band would be kind of organ centric, because I didn't fancy myself much as a guitarist, but I thought if we had organ, then that would really suit me.
Sure.
So it was just a case of it was more convenient really for me to play guitar as I was writing. Well, actually, I'd written the song at that stage, and then we were trying to sort of work out. We were doing a few Traffic covers, probably pretty badly. But then David decided he couldn't make any commitments, so I had to find a keyboard player. And I'm not sure how that happened, but Lee Neal turned up. I think he was playing with a band called 1987 at that stage. And he had a Farfisa organ, was about as different as you can get from a B3 rig. And I thought, okay. But he was a great player, so.
Right. Was that then the birth of Spectrum, or was this a band that came before Spectrum?
Well, we eventually became Spectrum. I don't think we had any other names.
Right. How did the name come about? Because it's so evocative these days, you know. It's
Look, it was the Spectrum then, because everything was the.
That's right.
And Helen, my wife at that stage, came up with the name. She came up with the name Ariel too. So.
Right.
Names are really hard, and at least I thought they were. So it was good to go, okay, thanks, darling.
Right. Mm. Thinking back to that period, how long did it take before you suddenly went, we've really got something going here? Was that quick, or did it have to evolve over a period of time?
We were fortunate in that we got a semi-residency anyway at a gig in De Grave Street called Lucifer's, which was being run by a schoolboy called Mike Gadinski.
Oh, right.
And it was a Sharpie hangout, but when we turned up there for the first gig, with all these Sharpies hanging out, and the biggest Sharpie came over and said, you guys are all right. So he looked after us, and we never had a problem.
Right, excellent. As I said, though, but how long did it take before you thought, we've actually got something going here that's good? This is what I've been working for.
Yeah, no, look...
Is that too hard?
I'm sort of pretty insecure. But what I thought was good that we were doing by playing at Lucifer's was that they had these bands coming through. And I thought, well, we're getting other musicians to hear the band and go, oh, this is an odd sort of band, because still... By and large, bands were doing covers.
Mm.
And so any band doing completely or nearly completely original stuff was still the exception.
And probably finding it hard to get gigs, to be honest, because people like to relate to the music they know.
Yes, but it wasn't as cutthroat then. I think the audience knew that they were behind what was going on overseas, and we were only getting news... from overseas, a month or so after it already happened.
Yes, there's a delay.
There was the delay. So people were prepared to accept that something different might be kind of interesting, because they'd never heard it before doesn't mean it's not good. So I think the audiences weren't quite as... Well, there wasn't anything else. They loved, and everybody loved music.
Yes.
You know? So it's not like these days.
No, well, we might talk about that a little bit later on too. Were you on a subsistence living at that stage, or were you able to be comfortable? Were you earning enough money as a band?
Oh, no, we never were comfortable.
No, I didn't.
The first song I wrote was I'll Be Gone. Someday I'll Have Money.
Okay.
And that was very much the way I felt. I just wrote what I felt, and it's still true.
It really struck a chord with people, didn't it?
Well, eventually it did. You know, we did a demo of it, and... It didn't have a harmonica.
Ah.
And it got rejected by EMI, which I thought was not very
poor decision.
Not, yes. Yeah. Not very far, thank you. But when we, as soon as we added the harmonica to it, it changed it, and we were, by then we were playing kind of regularly at Sebastian's, and I knew that that song was a goer. At the same time, the band was changing as well. We were coming, we were described as a progressive band later because the, that terminology didn't exist.
No, no.
But we were experimenting. So we were moving away from the snappy sort of 3 minute tunes. I'll sing my song and
I'll be gone. That particular song, I think it's fair to say that no matter where you go and where you play, whether it's tomorrow or a year ago, it's almost like people expect you to play that.
Well, it's not almost.
They do.
They do. By the time it's come by, I'll be gone. I'll sing my song and I'll be gone.
Listen to older voices, the magic of memories. I'm Rob Greaves, and with me is Mike Rudd. And Mike is talking about the formation of Spectrum and that group's most well-known hit, I'll Be Gone.
Is it a burden to you, or is it something that gives you great pleasure still?
No, it gives me great pleasure, actually. And I feel very fortunate to have at least one song. I mean, when you think about it, we started from the top and then drifted down.
Oh, I think you're being unkind to yourself.
Slid down, yes. But no, we're very fortunate to have the one song. And in a way, I don't begrudge the fact that we didn't have very much else, because it's given us that sense of freedom, that we can play whatever we like because people don't know what to expect.
Well, that's true enough. And I guess if you look back at the number of bands that have formed and broken up since that period over the last 4 or 5 decades, very few of them can put their hands up and say, well, we've got an iconic song. So that must give you some pleasure. And so, It's almost like it was a gift in some ways, isn't it?
Indeed.
It was kind to you.
It was written with such ease in the first place. It was just a matter of finding the way to present it, and adding the harmonica was that last thing.
What entered into your psyche or your mind to mutate Spectrum into Merseps?
Well, at that stage, I think that was probably contemporary with the drink laws changing from, you know, from early night closing to being more expansive. So pubs became a venue, you know, a possible venue. And what Spectrum was playing wasn't pub music.
Gotcha. Okay.
So, and we were kind of getting, the options were sort of disappearing. The options weren't there for us to play in the pubs. We were playing at universities, at discotheques, and that's just about the end of the story.
Right.
So, yes, it was a desperate act, but it also gave us another mode of expression, which was still, to the uncultured ear, still a continuum where we weren't Spectrum and Merseps. We're still Spectrum, and some songs we called ourselves Merseps.
Gotcha. What about Ariel? What was the genesis of Ariel then?
The demise of Spectrum was the genesis of Ariel.
Okay, then let's take that step back. Why was there a demise for a band that was so popular?
Well, first we lost Lee Neal, who just died recently. Recently, we found out. Lee left the band, and we spent a while as a three-piece searching for a keyboard player. And that was actually kind of, you know, the second keyboard player is always the most difficult. And we eventually found a player, John Mills, in Canberra. But then Ray Arnott said, "Oh no, I'm out. I've had enough of this." And I thought, well, then it's not going to be Spectrum anymore.
Mm.
And so it wasn't going to be Spectrum anymore. And Nigel and Tim turned up as an item, and they were looking around for a band to play with. And apparently, I mean, I wasn't aware of this. They were there, so I thought, oh, well, let's play. And I recognised that Tim was just a prodigy. So it wasn't a big decision for me, but it was probably a big decision for them. And management was involved in that somehow. So there was a momentum, because the last concerts here and in Adelaide were, you know, remarkable concerts. It was like every person that ever liked us ever had turned up to these concerts, and the feeling was so generous and warm that management couldn't ignore that.
Mm.
And so we needed to have another band going, but I also needed the band to be completely different from what we'd been doing. And so that meant none of the old songs, apart from I'll Be Gone, perhaps, and had to write a completely new repertoire in the space of, you know, a month or so.
Was that challenging for you?
Yes. And if you have a look at the lyrics that I was coming up with at that stage, there was a man under pressure there, big time.
Yeah. Was there any other issue that Bill wouldn't have gone along with you at that stage? Because I've got to say that whether it's right or wrong, when we think about you, it's hard not to think about you and Bill. That's not necessarily healthy, but it's just a reality.
Yeah, it was true. And look, he was a very grounding presence, but I could always talk him around in the end.
What was the strength of Ariel?
Look, I think there was an incredible energy that came from Tim and John Mills. Actually, they fired off each other. They were very similar kind of talents, but Tim was just in a realm of his own, really. And we recorded Jamaican Farewell fairly early on in the piece, so we got a good run at it.
Mm.
People, you know, if it wasn't a big seller, it got played. That was part of the momentum deal. And I think we created some kind of expectation.
Was it, and this is where my knowledge is a little hazy here, was it Ariel that got you into trouble in Sydney with the radio stations?
It was actually Melbourne.
It was Melbourne.
Yeah, right. And
what was the story behind that?
Well, Ariel and Daddy Cool were kind of linked up. Well, Spectrum and Daddy Cool, but also Ariel and Daddy Cool, and 3XY had a moment where they thought they'd do this live broadcast of the two bands, Australasia.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big deal. But that stage, we'd put out the album, and there had been 5 tracks, at least, that had been banned for airplay by radio stations. The Federation of Commercial Radio Stations had banned 4 or 5 tracks.
For people listening, was that because of the titles or was it because of the lyrics in?
They actually quoted lyrics in their rationale.
Right.
So Stan Roth, who was part of 3XY at that stage, said, well, you'll have to give us a song list of what you're playing. And in there was some kind of... I don't think I did anything wrong consciously.
Right.
Because we gave them a song list and it had some of the songs that had been banned on it. They didn't read it. They just assumed that we were not going to play those songs.
Oh, boy.
So we got about 15 seconds into Chicken Shit and they took us off. When you push it down.
None of your tricks now. I need that chicken shit. I need a fix now. A fix up chicken shit.
And you know, it was Stan was just furious with us till he died, basically. And I can understand that, but I plead naive innocence.
Mm. And I mean, these days that track would be looked upon as almost ho hum.
Yeah, although you know, Confessions of a Psychopathic Cowpoke could be
That might be a different case. That's right. We talked about the strength of Ariel. Did it have a weakness?
Well, yes. It was a put together band. That was the weakness.
Mm.
It hadn't had the organic beginnings of Spectrum and allowed to kind of find its feet. And then we were under pressure from the word go, and in a year, those cracks were turning into chasms.
Mm.
And we finish this part of the program with Ariel's 1973 hit, Jamaican Farewell.
Yeah!
Do join Mike and I once again next week for more stories that include the origins and demise of Ariel, how Mike wrote a rock opera, and how the second lineup of Ariel went to the UK to ostensibly record that piece of work and found themselves in the Abbey Road studios. That's next week, Mike Rudd on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program. Listen to Older Voices is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is podcast to you through the Toorak Times and TAG.